Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we've got a terrific show for you. We're going to talk about the state of journalism in the United States today, how it's been changing over the past decade or two, and what can be done for those of us who love journalism and regard it as a necessary, mandatory institution in a free society to see that it be preserved and expanded in the coming years. We've got a great guest for you, Geneva Overholser, former editor of the Des Moines Register, talking with us about these issues. But first, before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Media News Group is the fourth largest newspaper company in the United States. The privately owned company includes 57 daily newspapers throughout California, the Rocky Mountain region, and the Northeast, with a combined circulation of approximately 5.5 million. Last month, Media News informed the Newspaper Guild that they would be consolidating news operations in August between the Contra Costa Times and the six papers known as the Alameda News Group, or ANG. ANG is part of the Northern California Media Workers Guild. The Contra Costa Times is not. Amanda Valentine, a national mobilizer for the Newspaper Guild, says that many people suspected the consolidation was imminent.
It kind of follows Dean Singleton's business pattern of cut, consolidate, and cluster. But it was done in a way, we believe, to specifically bust the union, to get the union out of the whole scheme of things.
Valentine says Media News has intentionally allowed ANG to shrink while adding staff to the Contra Costa Times. Now Media News is claiming that they can no longer legally recognize ANG's union because ANG has fewer editorial staffers than the Contra Costa staff.
We filed several unfair labor practice charges at the National Labor Relations Board. Our contract language grants us jurisdiction by location. So certainly, the union still represents all of the employees that are in the geographic locations mentioned in the contract.
Editorial staff at ANG are worried that the union will lose its clout or disappear altogether in the new group. Media News says if the union wants to represent the employees, there has to be an election. Ballantyne says the union agrees that there should be a vote, but
we're not interested in just imposing the union on this whole new group of people, but we're also not interested in having the bargaining rights of ANG, which has been fighting for their union for 20 years, having those rights revoked because the company decided to restructure its management. Without a union, there aren't protections for the editorial staff. People can be laid off and fired at the whim of their supervisors. There don't have to be any regular pay raises. Dean Singleton has said publicly that he believes that newspapers won't exist in 10 years. So there are a lot of reasons why the journalists at ANG are very upset that the union has been unrecognized by the company. And I think a lot of people would like to see Bang East Bay brought into the fold as quickly as possible.
Lauren Glenn Davidian is the executive director of CCTV's Center for Media and Democracy in Vermont. Involved in community media for more than 20 years, she recently won the George Stoney Award for Humanistic Communications, presented by the Alliance for Community Media. Davidian first got involved in community media as a young college student. Trained as an anthropologist, she wanted to use some public access equipment to document people's stories in Burlington, Vermont. When the cable company escorted her to a closet filled with old, broken-down equipment, Davidian changed her career path.
And I said, well, that's not going to work, so I'll be back. And essentially turned very quickly from a video maker, documentary maker, to a community organizer. Once I explained what public access TV was, it didn't take people long to say, that's what I want to do.
The internet, she says, is no replacement for public access television.
We can't even say community media is less significant than it's been in the past. It it's actually more significant because it's actual real estate that the public controls and uses. And we have to keep fighting for it.
And the fight is on. Several states have passed video franchise legislation threatening the viability of public access. Cable and phone companies are pushing for laws that absolve them from their public interest obligations. Davidian is undeterred. She says it's not easy work, but we need to keep our foot in the door.
The highest and best use of free speech is to be able to mobilize change to create communities that we want to live in. We have to have a set aside. We have to claim a portion of the public property that commercial interests use, whether they're a phone company or a cable company or a satellite company. They're using either public airwaves, public spectrum, or public rights of way to generate profits. And that's public, and it belongs to us.
Davidian says the only way to create diversity in media is through diversity in ownership.
What we really want is as many different kinds of people and entities owning the media as possible. And right now, when it's in the hands of a few companies that are global in nature, you don't have diversity. We have to have a place for people that don't have commercial interests to say what they need to say.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a show that we're going to be talking about journalism, the state of journalism. We have a wonderful guest for you. Geneva Overholser covered City Hall and State Legislature for the Colorado Springs Sun and spent 5 years freelancing from Africa and Europe before joining the Des Moines Register, one of the most distinguished newspapers in the United States, as its editor. Under her leadership, the paper won a Pulitzer Prize for Public Service in 1991. Since then, Overholser served as an editorial board member for the New York Times and as ombudsman for the Washington Post and as a syndicated columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group. She is now the Curtis B. Hurley Chair in Public Affairs Reporting at the University of Missouri's Journalism School and the board chair for the Center for Public Integrity. It is my privilege to welcome to Media Matters Geneva Overholser.
It's great to be with you, Bob. I wish I were with you in beautiful Urbana. It's pretty rainy in Washington, D.C.
Well, it'll clear up. Don't worry. We get our share of rain here, too. That's why the crops grow so tall.
Yep.
You know from your days in Iowa.
I remember it well.
And in fact, that we're jumping right into the heart of the matter with that allusion, because when you were the editor of the Des Moines Register in the late 1980s, it was the premier news media for covering the agricultural beat. And in many ways, what's happened with that beat is reflective of some of the problems journalism has faced in the last 15 or 20 years in the United States. Talk, just because our listeners here in the heart of the richest farmland in North America appreciate this issue probably more than many others would. Explain sort of what happened.
Yeah. Well, it's surely something I see quite powerfully now that I'm based in D.C., because the kind of coverage that we see now focuses on the White House, it focuses on Congress, but the various federal agencies, which have so much to do with how we live our lives throughout the nation, are very poorly covered. And I think it really is a kind of a direct consequence of the kinds of profit pressures that increasing corporatization of media put on the newspapers across the land that used to bring their own specialties to Washington coverage. So, for example, when the Register was in its heyday, and even when I took over, which I like to believe was a continuation of the heyday, we had five reporters in our Washington Bureau just for Des Moines, and one of them was always focusing entirely on the Department of Agriculture. And we, you know, when I came back to the Register, we actually were running an ad saying only one newspaper has won more Pulitzers for national coverage than the Des Moines Register. Congratulations to the New York Times. Well, almost all of that national coverage was on agricultural issues. Now the Bureau has been folded in with Gannett's Bureau, and it has one person, a very capable person, but I doubt that she does much agricultural coverage. And you know, the second best at the time, I would say, was the Kansas City Star. Well, I don't think they're doing much agricultural coverage. So as a consequence, we have this huge sector of American business and, of course, American life, which is fundamentally undercovered. And you could duplicate that from sector to sector. Mining, the Louisville Courier-Journal just pulled back its last reporter in mining country. Think of the impact on that in Washington, just on and on.
And, you know, as you point out, when there are cutbacks in journalism, and I want to talk in a second about the extraordinary report from the Project for Excellence in Journalism on this point, but when there are cutbacks in journalism, it's not just that there are fewer reporters covering Britney Spears' cosmetic surgery. It means that there are just fewer reporters actually covering the affairs of state.
Absolutely. It means fewer reporters. It means less money for training so those reporters can really gather the tools to use to do deep projects, investigative reporting, often computer-assisted reporting. It means less space in the newspaper or on the broadcast. It's just really an extremely impoverishing thing for American society because, you know, part of this Britney Spears thing is that it's cheaper. It's a whole lot cheaper to just sort of prattle on the tube about something everybody else is prattling on about or to run cheap wire copy about celebrities than it is to do investigative reporting. And so, unsurprisingly, the most expensive things go first.
You know, the 2006 report of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, one of the striking statements it made in there was, quote, "At many old media companies, though not all, the decades-long battle at the top between idealists and accountants is now over. The idealists have lost." And in that report, they go on to chronicle really the sharp decline in the number of working journalists in community after community. And I recall off the top of my head in Philadelphia, for example, which is one of the cities they focused upon, that there's been something like a 40% drop-off in the number of actual working journalists covering that community for, you know, as full-time working journalists.
That's exactly right, and the drop-off continues. And I have to say, part of it, I mean, I used to feel, and I think I was right, that if we had but invested in research and development, in growing our readership, then we really could have headed this off. Now I honestly believe that there are no villains. I mean, the guy who owns the Philadelphia Inquirer now, Tierney, is struggling to simply come out even. The Boston Globe lost money last quarter last year. I mean, we're talking about newspapers now far from sort of just printing money the way they did for so many years. They really, many of them are struggling to survive because once the turn came in the kind of economic underpinnings of newspaper, it came so quickly. So we really are dealing with institutions which are, you know, the advertising is such an important part, typically 80% of what pays for a newspaper's income, and advertisers are leaving newspapers, and they're kind of following the eyeballs onto the web. But that model hasn't become sustainable yet. So legacy media, as we call them, old media, are challenged to stay alive. I think it's an important issue for civically concerned citizens to become engaged in.
You know, it seems like you've got two issues running parallel to explain the crisis of journalism today that you just mentioned that are distinct, but they also go hand in hand. One is the rise of the internet and digital technologies, which have undermined the economic basis of print journalism and, I think, soon broadcast journalism, such that it doesn't even exist anymore. And then on the other hand, the broader issue, which is the decline in journalism, which precedes the internet.
Exactly. They definitely go hand in hand.
But this decline in journalism, then you leave yourself with a situation where you haven't cultivated a readership or an audience for journalism among people, say, under 20 or 25 today. So they're not looking for it. So it just exacerbates the problem.
It does indeed, although many in that audience are more affected by the reporting or the paucity of reporting at newspapers than I think they sometimes realize. That is to say that typically in any city in this country, the greatest fund of original reporting is coming still out of newsrooms. And it is true we shouldn't overstate the death of newspapers. You know, on any given Super Bowl Sunday, more people are reading their Sunday newspapers than are watching the football game, and nobody says football is dead. So I do think it's important to note that they still are extremely extremely important, and what happens now to them will make an enormous difference because newspapers influence other media, including, of course, preeminently now, the web. And so much of what goes on the web really draws from or feeds off, depending on your perspective, what happens with newspapers. So we're going to have to figure out this issue of how you pay for content creation on the web. I'm a great enthusiast about the democratization potential of the web, but there's nothing magic about it. We could just recreate the same flaws on the web and have only rich white males, you know, between a certain narrow age spectrum, or only certain concerns reflected there, or great mania of celebrity obsession there. I mean, there's everything on the web, and what develops as the most promising and most prominent elements will depend in part on how we all vote with our feet and how we contribute to policy development.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Geneva Overholser, the former editor of the Des Moines Register, ombudsman for the Washington Post, currently the Curtis B. Hurley Chair in Public Affairs Reporting at the University of Missouri School of Journalism, based in Washington, D.C., as well as the board chair for the Center for Public Integrity, the group founded by Charles Lewis. We've had Chuck Lewis and Roberta Baskin, his successor as the executive director of the CPI, the Center for Public Integrity, on Media Matters in the past, and we're going to be talking about that later in the program. This show is pre-recorded. We taped it a few days before going on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, and let us do the talking for you. With Geneva Overholser, we're talking about the state of journalism today, and I think she has emerged, I think it's safe to say, as one of the leading journalists who's really been thinking hard about the crisis journalism is in as a business model, and what needs to be done or can be done to rectify the situation so we don't see journalism go the way of the horse and buggy in the coming generation. Before we go into some of the solutions and some of the positive stuff that's happening, I do want to talk a little bit more about the dimensions of the crisis, because I think that is really something a lot of people are not necessarily that aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about the decline in actual resources going to local coverage, covering local communities and community after community in this country, and agriculture, and the decline in the resources going to covering all the agencies of government which affect us, which increasingly are just uncovered because there aren't journalists there who have enough time and resources to do the job. Another area that's received a lot of probably more criticism and more awareness has been the coverage of international affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you could just talk a little bit about what has happened to the resources going to covering the world for Americans by U.S. news media.
Yeah, I'm very worried about that. You know, we worry about local coverage, as you said, but in fact, the one increasingly promising sort of sustainable economic model does look like what they call hyper-local coverage. And ethnic media are doing well, weekly media are doing well. So I think in the long run, if people make wise decisions, the local news coverage solution is going to emerge. What I worry about is that we live in a nation with big government and big business, and we live in an increasingly globalizing world, and we play such an important role in it. And we're seeing a great, great reduction in national and, as you point out, international news, and we cannot afford that as a democracy with such an important role to play in the world. This comes across directly as a consequence of what we were just talking about, which is that these media companies are putting less and less into reporting, and often they're putting less and less into reporting because they really can't figure out how they're going to be sustaining themselves in the future. I don't want to let these guys off the hook. I think CEOs of media companies have been, by and large, I hate to say it, really mediocre. I don't think they've had vision. I don't think they, you know, it's not just that they haven't had a sense of corporate responsibility. It's just that they really have danced to the tune of Wall Street. They came up through decades of there being a monopoly, and they could just do what they needed to do to make themselves extremely profitable. The model, as we've discussed, is no longer there. So now to do international coverage, which is a very expensive thing, one company I know of that has several reporters in Baghdad said to me that essentially one reporter there costs them $1 million a year. You know, with the support facilities, the Iraqis who work for them, the security, which is just incredible.
Insurance.
So we're talking about fewer and fewer bureaus existing throughout the world. And what people say, like, you know, broadcast executives say, well, of course, we can use local people so well. There are ways in which we are getting a better picture of the rest of the world than we used to. If you want to be a well-educated American on international affairs, Monde in French, and you can listen to the BBC, and you can get your Guardian Weekly here at your home, and you can get the BBC, Economist, etc. But for the average American, the diet of national and international news, which is readily available, is becoming ever poorer, which I think is a real issue for us in this important country.
Gilbert Cranberg, who's the former editorial page editor.
My mentor. He's the one who brought me to the Register, the most wonderful man.
That's why I mentioned him at the Des Moines Register. Earlier this year, he called for a formal investigation of why the news media dropped the ball so badly on the build-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and did not get to the bottom of why the government was doing it.
To say the least.
And I'd like your sense on, you know, whether that's a good idea, what would come of that. But also, you know, what's your analysis of, from what you know, of why the press coverage was so lacking in the year or two up to the invasion of Iraq and even thereafter during the occupation?
Well, I love Gil's idea because I think even though it's become generally accepted and sort of the conventional wisdom, and some of the biggest papers have even apologized or all but apologized, it's that we bring more clarity to something when there's a kind of a formal examination. So Gil also proposed that there be a special Pulitzer for the Knight Ridder coverage. Knight Ridder is now part of McClatchy, I should say here, that my husband runs the McClatchy Washington operation. But I think that McClatchy and Knight Ridder are getting recognition. And partly they represent papers that are not based here in Washington, New York, Boston. You know, they're not coastal, really. They are really representing American interests, and I think they do get less caught up in the whole inside the Beltway thing, which was, to answer your second question, part of what happened. It seems to me it's multifaceted. We have to remember that 9/11 was extremely unsettling for people in Washington and New York. I've sort of got a foothold in both cities, and I certainly understand that there were personal feelings here among journalists living in these cities, as there were, of course, across America. But also I think it very much is part and parcel of what we've been talking about this increasing corporatization, kind of taking the juice out of newspapers. I mean, you have to have stuff to stand up against not only the powerful in government, but kind of the zeitgeist. I mean, you know, the spirit of the times, we have to recall, was very much that patriotism demanded a kind of an acquiescence in whatever. We'd been attacked in our homeland. And so many of us Americans understand that that is not what patriotism is for journalism. But it's sort of hard to remember. It took some gumption to remember that. I was on a television show with former Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming, and he wagged his long, elegant finger at me and said, "Now maybe you will give up on that skepticism." And I said, "With all due respect, Senator Simpson, skepticism is patriotism for journalists." But it was hard to remember that. And I think the kind of combination of generally a reduction in heft and in the sort of intrepid reporting combined with the spirit of those times, and then finally the Bush administration's remarkable skill at keeping on message, at closing itself off from conversations, it just combined to produce disastrously weak coverage, which was a terrible thing for this nation in the build-up to that war. And I think, you know, I think an examination of it might be a good reminder for everyone that this happened and a commitment not to do it again. It wasn't the first time the press has failed, of course.
Yeah, and you know, let's hope it's the last time. But I think Gil Cranberg's point was that it probably won't be the last time unless we get to the bottom of what caused it last time out.
I don't think it'd be the last time anyway. He's an eternal optimist, bless his heart. I mean, the media are very flawed. I think anyone who's a critic of the media certainly has all kinds of good points to make about them. They're very flawed. They're creatures of their times. But they're absolutely essential. I'm always reminded of Churchill's point about democracy is the worst form of government except all the others. You know, media are our worst form of really getting reliable information except for all the others. I mean, journalism is so critical, so anything we can do to bolster it, I think, is helpful.
You know, along those lines, as an aside, just from research I've been doing recently, Thomas Jefferson, during his administration as president, was so critical of the newspapers and journalists of his day, it boggles the mind. I mean, he held them in the greatest contempt
imaginable. I know, it's so funny to read his quotes. The one we always quote is, you know, rather have a free press than a free government. But then during his administration, he hated everything about them, didn't
he? But to his great credit, he didn't use that as a reason to censor.
No.
But rather to expand the press.
Exactly.
And I think that's the Churchillian approach to the media and to the news media.
Yeah.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Geneva Overholser, former editor of the Des Moines Register and ombudsman for the Washington Post, currently the Curtis B. Hurley Chair in Public Affairs Reporting at the University of Missouri School of Journalism, based in Washington, D.C., and also the board chair for the Center for Public Integrity, the outstanding investigative journalism organization based in Washington that for almost two decades now has been breaking story after story that no other journalists have the time, resources, or commitment to pursue, unfortunately. But we go on to the solutions and talk about some of this exciting stuff. I do want to go into another area, if we can, Geneva, which is dealing with women and minorities in newsrooms, which, as in the realm of journalism, I think it's safe to say, having taught in this area now for longer than I like to remember, but you know, approaching my third decade coming up soon, this has always been a very important issue and a sensitive issue, because the number of women and especially ethnic minorities working in newsrooms has always been well below the proportion of the population.
Absolutely, and it surely is one of the main reasons the media have declined in how compelling and how engaging they are to the world. I mean, it's a kind of a simple thing, you know. If you look at a newspaper and you are nowhere reflected in it, it's not going to be as engaging to you. And it's just been so true for so long that newspapers were inordinately focused on kind of the powerful. And the powerful, alas, have been, over the years, way overrepresenting white and male. So, and wealthy, of course. So we haven't gotten all of life's experiences in the paper. We haven't gotten all the views, the divergent hopes in the paper. This goes for other media, too, which have generally done even a worse job of it, I think. So this, you know, it became a concern that people understood, and they started trying to do sort of, you know, numerical, we've got to have this, we've got to have that. Those were fairly pro forma. So many women and people of color, and even young white men of just divergent views, went into newsrooms and just felt as if they had to be stamped into, you know, this is the news judgment that prevails. And it's hard when you're new to try to change the news judgment, especially in newsrooms, which do tend to be very risk averse, kind of macho places. So all these years this has been true, and then they tried to come up with these solutions, and even those solutions, these sort of almost quota-like solutions, are falling now again prey to reductions, both because they're not hiring, so you can't bring in this new blood, and because among those who are leaving, there's a greater representation, cruelly enough, of people of color, partly because they just can't stand it. You know, why be in a newsroom that feels like a sinking ship and it won't even listen to your voice about, well, maybe you ought to be out in those Spanish language neighborhoods talking to people, you know?
Now, when you came into journalism in the three decades or so ago.
Yeah, three plus.
Three plus.
71.
And, you know, women were far less prevalent in newsrooms at that point. Now, I should know this, and I feel bad that I don't. Had there been many women who'd been editors of major dailies the size of the Des Moines Register when you assumed that position?
No, it was remarkable. As a matter of fact, just after I took the editorship, Gannett ran an ad in EMP bragging about the fact that, you know, they're
editor
only
and publisher, for those of our listeners not on the inside. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. The Gannett Company, which owned the paper, ran an ad in Editor and Publisher magazine saying, you know, there are only, I've forgotten, four women who are editors of papers of, you know, 250,000-plus subscribers or whatever, and two of them are at in Gannett. And the funny part of that was that, you know, Gannett had told the publisher who hired me that I wouldn't even have made the short list on paper, but, you know, my publisher was a good judge of horse flesh. But no, there hadn't been a lot. The sad news is that even though there certainly have been more since then, we're in danger of becoming a kind of a pink-collar ghetto, because now J schools, as you know, are overwhelmingly female. Our salaries are so low, I worry that men are not going to be willing to continue with this, and mm-hmm. we're going to have a whole lot of women in low-paid, low positions in newsrooms, and not very many women still at the top. It's not a great situation.
Yeah, one of the other changes that's taken place in newsrooms, certainly since you started in the 70s, Reflecting the discussion we've been having, Geneva Overholser, has been, I think, in the morale of working journalists. You know, in the 1970s and into the 1980s, I think journalists tended to have a great deal of pride in their work and their profession and be very defensive about criticism of it from college professors or just anyone who wasn't part of the profession. And I think that in the last, I'm just pick a figure out of the sky, 15 or 20 years increasingly, but especially in the past 5 or 10 years, a lot of journalists have become, like yourself, I think, become much more concerned about the profession and concerned about fundamental problems. And this has been, in my sense, reflected in the morale of a lot of working journalists. Has this been your experience?
I mean, that's an interesting construction of it. I don't differ with anything. I think I would have described it differently. I think there was so much more confidence when we came into journalism, those of us who came in the 70s. And the confidence was both deserved and misplaced. I mean, the confidence was deserved because people had confidence in us. They did. The statistics were much higher, both in terms of circulation and credibility. So, but there was an enormous amount of arrogance and a kind of a, you know, don't approach the castle walls.
That
can't possibly be sustained in a democracy. And honestly, I felt that at the time. I remember thinking it's remarkable how arrogant we are. And it did strike me as not a promising thing. On the other hand, to be young and in a newsroom then really was very heaven. It was spectacular. You really had an impact on your community. I was at the Colorado Springs Sun, now defunct. And, you know, we had write-in candidates for City Hall who won. I mean, it was just amazing. So it was great. On the other hand, there were wide swaths of the community who were not part of it. There was, you know, there was an unassailability about it. I mean, it's a much more promising time now. And in terms of, you know, listening to the needs of our news consumers and trying to be responsive to our communities and holding ourselves accountable for our impact on our community.
And one of the issues that, along with this, has come under considerable criticism within the journalistic community has been the whole notion of objectivity and of professional journalism, which, you know, is, I think, in the last 5 years or so, in your own work, too, has, you know, people saying, what exactly does this mean? How does this translate? And, you know, for some of our listeners not really familiar with this, and I think we have a wide listenership and people who aren't studying journalism or working in newsrooms, they hear the term objectivity, and they sort of hear that's sort of the canon of journalism, but they don't really know what that means. Maybe you could give a little background on when you came to the profession, what that term meant, and then what some of the concerns are about it.
Yeah, this is such an interesting arena because, really, I think when we have this discussion, there are two things going on. One is we're not so satisfied with this notion of objectivity, and the other one is we have been interpreting it differently in recent years, I think. So it does pay to go back. First of all, as you well know, but not all of our listeners may, objectivity, and it became a canon only really in, what, the 20s of the last century. It's not been around all that long. Mm-hmm. Before that, there was this great cacophony of voices, many of them partisan. I mean, the beginnings of journalism in this country sound a lot like some of the criticisms of journalism today. We've got all these people shouting, and there's a lot of partisanship, and there's a lot of emotion, you know. Mm-hmm. You think sort of Tom Paine, although he could write better than most of the folks today. But anyway, so we came up with this notion, objectivity kind of grew up in some ways as a commercial response to changes. But the notion was that we were supposed to be, I mean, I think at its best, objectivity as a notion has been trying to come closer to an almost scientific kind of notion of truth. And you know, we're going to give it to you as straight as we can without our views in it, without coloring it fear or favor, as the Times said. And so over the years, I think that served the American media fairly well, and the public has come to believe that's what we're supposed to do. So when I was ombudsman at the Post, I kept hearing, wait, I thought you were supposed to be objective here, and in fact, I'm seeing, you know, a sneering about politics here, or I'm seeing a kind of an anti-Catholicism or whatever. So now people are thinking, wait a minute, I thought objectivity was it. Well, over the years, I think one of the things that has arisen is a kind of a stupid interpretation of objectivity, which means if you say, you know, it's sort of an on the one hand, on the other hand. And so you get these idiotic false dichotomies about, say, global warming, which has been a terribly covered subject, partly because of this idiotic interpretation of objectivity. You say, well, you know, many scientists believe that the human effect on, and then you say, on the other hand, other scientists believe, and if it's 97-3, you still do this on the other hand, and you make it, this is what balance has come to look like. Well, that's not presenting the truth. So I think the current interpretation of objectivity has a lot of things wrong with it. One is that false sense of balance. The other is this sort of notion that in order to be objective, you have to be dispassionate. But people want a human voice, and people want to believe that reporters are engaged in their community. I remember Bill Raspberry, wonderful columnist at the Washington Post, talked about the fact that you could always tell that the Post was for the Redskins, the football team here, but you could never tell that they were for the city. And it's an interesting point. People want to believe their media are for their community. So it's created a rich stew now of responses, and I think we have yet to see, don't you, what's going to happen with this whole concept.
Well, I think the point you get at, Geneva, is true about, especially with the reliance upon official sources, and what happens then is being a professional journalist or being objective means simply taking official commentary from each side of the aisle,
yeah,
and not actually investigating who's telling the truth and who's lying.
Exactly, or just taking official commentary from the White House and not pointing out what even many reporters know, which is this is balderdash. I remember when I was on the editorial board of the New York Times and the whole concept of Star Wars came up, and I was writing about national defense issues, and we would editorialize against it, but the newspaper coverage, which was by Michael Gordon, actually, who's still at the Times writing about national defense issues. It's not really his fault, but the coverage would sort of say, you know, here's the president saying this, and there was very little sort of, few scientists think there's anything to this.
Mm-hmm.
So you're exactly right. The over-reliance, almost inevitable, I suppose, in some ways, reporting from Washington on powerful voices means you really don't get to tell the public much about even what you as a reporter know, much less what a lot of other experts know.
Yeah, and that reminds me of another anecdote, and I don't mean to just use trading horse stories here, but, you know, the great line that, you know, if you talk to an American journalist, you learn a lot more over a bar stool when you actually hear them talk about what they think than you do from reading their stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's something wrong with journalism if that's the case. It should almost be the other way.
Absolutely, and that's why some people are really doing it the other way. I used to sit there at the Des Moines Register, which, of course, has presidential candidates rolling through every hour, practically, during periods of every 4 years, and we would interview whatever the candidate was of du jour, and they would leave, and I would think, you know, we'd all be sitting there going, boy, did he get nervous when we asked him that, and what kind of an awkward you know, demeanor he has on this or that, and then the news story would come out. It would be just kind of, you know, that straight down the line stuff. We didn't give readers all we knew. Now, online, you can video the conference with your editorial board. You can give the tools of credibility to your consumers. They can go to the PDFs you looked at. You can give them the notes from your interview, whatever. I mean, it's a really rich feast now.
Our guest, Geneva Overholser, former editor of the Des Moines Register, where she led the paper to a Pulitzer Prize for Public Service in 1991. She's also been a board, editorial board member of the New York Times, ombudsman at the Washington Post, and is now the Curtis B. Hurley Chair in Public Affairs Reporting at the University of Missouri Journalism School, based in Washington, D.C., where she's also the board chair for the Center for Public Integrity. We've been talking about the state of journalism, recent, past, present, and hopefully future here on Media Matters. We're recording this show a few days before going on air, so please don't call in today. Just sit back, relax, enjoy the remainder of the show. We've got a lot of ground I want to cover still. And I think right now, one thing, since following up on your last point, Geneva Overholser, is election coverage. The one thing that the national media do a lot of is covering presidential races. I don't know how many other elections get much attention, but the national news media cover presidential races, and they're certainly covering next year's already.
Mm-hmm.
What is your sense of election coverage for an average American person living anywhere? How well served are they, in your view, by the type of coverage of the presidential race is going on now?
Well, the big criticism, of course, is that it's horse race coverage. I have to tell you, I don't jump on that bandwagon much. I may be really way too much of a political junkie, but I think we're finding out very interesting things about the candidates. I know many are concerned that the debates are not dignified or not enough or something. I think that's silly. I think the more debates we have and the more people talk and the more they follow up substantively with their differences of view, as we've been hearing between Obama and Clinton, the better. And if people say, well, we're not hearing about their positions, you can find everything you want about their positions online. And I think, in fact, if you read and listen and view widely, you will hear about their positions. And to the degree that it seems like an excess, well, you know, I do realize that people can tune it out, and maybe they'll become inured to it and won't tune back in at the right time. But generally speaking, I don't think this is one area of our national conversation that is ill-served. I rather like it.
Okay, what about the issue of who gets to be taken seriously as a candidate and how that determination is made? It's something that a lot of people on this show have raised in the past, because here we are, not a single vote's been cast, and, you know, candidates are running, and yet there are 8, 10, 12 candidates on each side. I guess news media say we can't give equal coverage to all of them. At some point, we have to weed out and say we think these are the serious ones we're going to devote resources to.
I think that is a much lesser concern today than it used to be. I used to be very worried about that when I was editor of the Des Moines Register. Now, I think it's a much lesser concern for two reasons. We have a gazillion debates, and every podunk candidate is standing up there just like Hillary and Barack, you know. I mean, Mike Gravel, is that how I pronounce his name?
You would know.
I'm not sure I would, because I'm such a print person. But he's there. Kucinich is there. I mean, they're not excluded. They get huge, huge exposure because of all these debates. And second, the traditional media, legacy media, old media, whatever we want to call them, are not the gatekeepers they once were. I mean, you can get everything you want on the web, and bloggers will talk about them if they're not, you know, running at the top of the race. And it's just, it is a way more democratized world, and it's so often true, it sounds to me today, as if people are worrying about what kind of gatekeepers these old media editors are, and the fence is gone.
Well, you know, one of the old debates, and I'd be interested in your take on it today, but for most of your career in journalism, one of the standing arguments has been that working journalists were a bunch of liberals with a strong liberal political bias. In fact, I was going for doing research for the show. I went through my file with your material, and I noticed an article by Brent Bozell, the conservative media critic, where he characterized you as a whining liberal windbag.
That was one of the more complimentary things they said about me.
Well, I mean, this is clearly a criticism you're familiar with. And have you responded to the argument that journalism has a liberal bias politically? And where do you think that argument stands today?
Well, I think there is a lot to it, and I think it's misconstrued. It's not that journalists are running out and voting for the most liberal candidate. It's that journalists tend to like change. I mean, by our very nature, those of us who go into journalism believe that we're serving the public by arming them with the information they need to govern themselves, which is not a sort of status quo thing. We sort of believe that they need to know if businesses are robbing them, you know, because we believe they ought to make change to make life better. And that, I suppose, is a sort of a liberal position, at least if you put it up against conservative in the old-fashioned way, which was essentially about not embracing change much. I mean, believing in the status quo, kind of keeping things on an even keel. That's not journalism. So in a way, it is probably an accurate response. And on certain specific issues, I think it is accurate. I think there are way more people in the newsroom who are, probably take quote-unquote liberal positions on gun laws, on abortion. So, and I think that so many journalists have failed to do a very good job of covering evangelical Christians, for example. Somebody wrote to me when I was ombudsman at the Post and said, you write about us as if we were Martians, and it's true. So there are some validity to the criticism, but the notion that that then translated into, you know, support for certain candidates, I think is a little bit more flawed. As for today, where it stands, what I worry about most today is the kind of vituperative quality of the debate, the vitriol. I mean, that comment about me was nothing compared to that. I practically brought down the Missouri website one time when I took a stand about something that made the right really mad. And if anything, the left has sort of learned how to do it almost as well as the right. So what I worry about is two things: the vitriolic quality of it, and also when it's deceptive. If we're going to have partisan media, then say it's partisan media. I just loathe the notion that Fox News, for example, would call itself the one that is, you know, we report, you decide. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, could they decide what to report?
Right. Well, yeah. I don't think there's anything wrong with having partisan media. But I just think it's really important that we have truth in packaging, you know, truth in labeling. And I worry about deceptiveness. I think we need transparency and accountability, which means honest behavior.
You know, I think that you've discussed already, Geneva Overholser, some of the extraordinarily positive developments of the Internet in terms of bringing information to people, drawing them into public life.
Yeah.
And we've also talked about the downside right now, which is it's contributing to the elimination of the business model, which makes possible resources for working journalists covering the nation, covering the world, covering their communities. And one of the areas that that attracted me to your work from the very beginning has been you've been thinking long and hard about, you know, what can we do as a society to arrest this process and get resources back to people covering their communities, doing journalism. And maybe you could just talk about some of your thoughts on this.
I've been having a lot of fun really trying to be more hopeful. You know, so many of us in the media world have been lamenting for so long. So a number of things occur to me, and many of them are already happening. One is that we have citizens who are demanding better media, and when they don't get them, they're just creating it. I mean, you know, of projects like the Deerfield Forum in New Hampshire, where a community was just not served by any newspaper, and so they kind of created their own online. It's, of course, much more plausible for people to do that when you don't have to own a press. This is happening across the country. People are taking media in their own hands, and you don't need a license to practice journalism. You do, however, I think, in order to serve the public well, need a certain understanding of the kind of founding principles of journalism, a commitment to try to do the best job you can with verification, for example. And so I think one of the promising things that's happening in the media world now is an understanding that there will be important roles that citizens play and a need to kind of work with people in communities, whether you are the existing media or your organizations that can help give citizens the tools to do responsible journalism. So that's one. Another one is a greater role for nonprofits. As you've noted, I'm chairing the board of one. I'm also on a couple of boards of other ones, the Committee of Concerned Journalists. It seems to me that nonprofits are going to take a greater and greater role. I don't think they'll ever supplant commercial media in this country, but if you think about what happens in other countries, they play a really large role. In the UK, you've got the BBC, which people contribute to. This would be anathema here. Through government requirement. You've got the Guardian, which is just a remarkable newspaper, which is held as a trust. We have a few examples of that in this country. The St. Petersburg Times in Florida is owned by the Poynter Institute, an educational institution, but we don't have many. And I think that this will increase. I think people in communities where their media are not serving them well ought to know that this model exists, and if there are wealthy people who want to get together to think about whether or not they might be able to either buy a failing newspaper, which is going to be increasingly available, by the way,
mm-hmm.
or create a new one, even if only online, then they ought to think about that, because these barriers are coming down. And, you know, ironically, as newspapers are valued less and less and less, this becomes more feasible to do.
Geneva Overholser, are there policies, public policies, you think that enlightened policies that could be put in place to help direct resources to journalism?
I wish I knew more about this, Bob. I bet you know more about it. I know you know more about it than I do. I do believe there are tax policies, for example, that would make it easier for this change that we were just discussing, this notion of a failing newspaper going to a trust. It would make it easier for these things, or estate laws make it easier for these things to happen. I have to say, there are a few people who've written about this very interestingly. Jay Hamilton and James T. Hamilton at mm-hmm. Duke University has written this book, All the News That's Fit to Sell.
Mm-hmm.
And you know others better than I do. I know this area less well than I wish I did, but yes, there are policies. I worry about how likely we are to get them passed in time for them to be effective. But Congress is more open to support of media issues now. We're moving more toward a shield law. So maybe it is a good time to think about policies. And boy, I'd like to become better educated on them myself.
Well, my sense, and you would know this better than I would, Geneva Overholser, is that in the last few years alone, there's really been a sea change of sorts in sort of thinking about the problem of journalism, that the crisis of the resources has been so great that it's getting everyone's attention in a way that it didn't 10 years ago.
Yeah, and that's really good news. And because of that, I'm doing things I wouldn't have been able to do. I'm putting on a forum here in March that has people from four countries that are looking toward the future of journalism in a way that we would have said, oh, no, that's not us. We couldn't do that. And somebody from Canada is going to come talk to us about requiring news literacy courses, which they do in every one of their provinces in junior high or high school. Somebody will come from the UK to talk about The Guardian held as a public trust and this remarkable report they do every year, which I bet you've seen, that shows their impact on the community in terms of the environment, in terms of social impact, et cetera, et cetera. Somebody's coming from Ghana to talk about community building online and by radio. And somebody's coming from Sweden to talk about government support for underserved voices, you know, so that there is direct support from government for media. And if we say, oh, you know, people say to me, oh, we don't, I mean, don't talk to us about that. That's so un-American. I think, you know, the time has passed where we put things off the agenda. It's really high time we began to think about how we can have a richer feast of media and the public interest in this country. So I sort of welcome the discussion, even if it's born of the lamentable truth, which is there's a huge, huge precipitous decline.
Is there a, when is this conference going to be held?
March 28th here in Washington, and it's called, it's, I have, as you said, I'm the Hurley Chair, and I have a Hurley Symposium every year.
Okay.
So that will be here, and this one this year is called New Media Enduring Values. We're working on projects in three communities, St. Paul, Milwaukee, and Des Moines. We're working with WHO-TV in Des Moines and with American Public Media, which you know is Minnesota Public mm-hmm. Radio's national brand, and then with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel to translate three of the elements of journalism from the wonderful book by Bill Kovich and Tom Rosensteel into richer form in digital media. So we're trying to, this one kind of goes back to putting, you know, how do you stem the tide? How do you help media do an even better job online? Because the online world offers great opportunities for legacy media, too.
Is there an easy website that you could give for people to find out about these Hurley seminars or conferences?
You know, that's such a good point. Now I prattle on and on about them, and I don't do a good job of putting this online, but there will be. They will be at both the Missouri School of Journalism website, which is www.journalism.missouri.edu.
Or just Google Missouri and Journalism.
Yeah, Missouri Journalism. And the other one is the Committee of Concerned Journalists, which was founded by Bill Kovich 10 years ago, and we are now kind of merged with them in our Washington Bureau here. And they're 8,000, 9,000 strong practitioners, and they do training in newsrooms. And we're kind of increasingly wanting to move toward becoming more of a coaching collaborative with Missouri and a kind of a think tank. So the Committee of Concerned Journalists has some of these. But we need to do it. With the New Media Enduring Values Project, we're going to be kind of revealing what has happened during the past year in October, and then we will definitely be putting more material online. I appreciate your asking.
Our guest, Geneva Overholser, former editor of the Des Moines Register, currently professor of journalism, endowed chair, Curtis Hanley Professor of Journalism at the University of Missouri School of Journalism, Curtis Hurley, excuse me, I can't get that right, joining us today on the phone. We're pre-recording this a few days before going on air, so please don't call in, just sit back and relax the last few minutes of the program. Geneva, what's your sense of journalism in some of these other nations? Do you get a sense they're experiencing the same problems we are?
Absolutely.
Or is the United
States? Absolutely. Yeah, I think they are. I mean, some of them are finding solutions that we haven't yet found. But I every time I travel or when we welcome international guests here, I find that the trends we're seeing here are affecting others. And those are the lucky ones. You know, there's so many countries in the world where the journalists are still struggling to breathe free
mm-hmm.
and are exposed to dangers in their everyday lives that we can't even imagine.
Mm-hmm.
If I could be so bold as to jump in with a book plug, the Missouri School of Journalism faculty have just published a book called What Good is Journalism? And it's edited by Kennedy and Moen, M-O-E-N. And it's a collection of chapters that look at journalism that is working. My chapter is on National Public Radio.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted your listeners to know that if they want to be hopeful, there is a new book out in paperback called What Good is Journalism by Kennedy and Moen, and it's a hopeful thing.
Well, talking about hopeful things, you are the board chair for the Center for Public Integrity.
Yeah.
And you and I off air have spoken about this at some length. I have been a supporter of the center since its inception.
I'm so grateful for that.
Well,
I love that you've had Chuck Lewis and Roberta Baskin on.
Well, I think some of our listeners probably not that familiar with it because it's a bit of an inside baseball group. Why don't you talk a little bit about the center, what it does, why it's important?
Yeah, it's so important. Chuck Lewis, bless his heart, after having a career in broadcast investigative reporting, was, for many of the same reasons you and I have talked about, becoming disenchanted with commercial media. And he, just out of his pocket and constant hours of work and huge heart, created this nonprofit, nonpartisan investigative journalism unit in Washington. It's a bit oddly named, and people don't quite know that, in fact, it's called the Center for Public Integrity, and some people think it's sort of a think tank. In fact, it's investigative journalism. We have a wonderful staff of investigative journalists. We do a lot of digging and data. And this is an organization that, I mean, it's the reason you know about the Lincoln bedroom scandal under the Clinton administration. It's the reason you know originally about Ken Lay's ties to the Bush administration. It just does extremely important work. We're right now looking at, I'm sure, the most comprehensive look at Superfunds, you know, the hazardous waste cleanup, and how little is being done in that arena. And you can get very practical information about your local communities. We're looking at federal advisory committees, calling that shadow government. We have this wonderful project called Well Connected, which is the best way you can go. Your listeners, I'm sure, would be interested in knowing about it. It sort of tells you who owns telecommunications and media and technology. So, you know, that's just a sample. But I really, really value the work of this center, and it's very hard to find support. You know, it kind of makes you sympathetic with the media moguls.
Well, the website, if people want to see the work of the center, is?
It's www.publicintegrity.org.
You know, when I had Chuck Lewis on, I recall, he said that a lot of people don't quite understand that what passes for investigative work oftentimes in news media today is really when someone inside the government makes a leak, and then it's reported like it's the result of an investigation, but it's just funneling leaked material.
Good point, exactly. It's not the kind of digging work that is real investigative reporting, which almost always takes quite a lot of time, frankly.
And you can understand why a CEO of a media conglomerate looks at that as purely a bucket of red ink.
Yeah, a bucket of red ink. Who wants to take all that time? You know, if you think about it, real investigative reporting either comes from digging at records or developing sources. Unless you're just lucky enough to have some good, you know, government person who's dying to leak something in the public interest and happens to call your number. It usually takes so much effort to build this up over time. And the center now has a long-established record, and it's just terribly important as news media reduce their presence in the nation's capital, and even those media that are here reduce the amount of time they spend on digging.
Geneva Overholzer, unfortunately I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they're trying to clear me out of the studio for the next program. I want to thank you very much for being our guest today
on
Media Matters.
Thank you so much, Bob. What a pleasure. I appreciate it.
It's been a blast. Geneva Overholzer, the Curtis Hurley Chair of Journalism, University of Missouri. Thank you for being our guest today, and I'll be back 1 week from today.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, sunny with a high around 80 degrees and light east winds. Tonight, mostly clear with a low in the upper 50s and light east winds. Tomorrow, sunny with the high in the upper 80s and southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the lower 60s and light southeast winds. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. 2 years, more than $200 billion on a tale of two cities. For some in New Orleans post-Hurricane Katrina, it's a story of despair. But today, stories of healing and hope.
There's reason to be hopeful. Let's grab hold to that hope, because hope needs help, and it needs help in the form of the federal government stepping up.
New Orleans is going to come back. Not coming back as fast as we'd like. We'd like more help from the federal government, but those of us who are in the trenches, we're here, and we're fighting.
Also, we'll discuss barriers black women still face in corporate America. Commentator Lynette Calfani cautions consumers against car mortgages. Plus, Eddie Glaw tackles Michael Vick's guilty plea on dogfighting charges. And Grammy-nominated jazz lion Christian Scott is back with a sophomore CD, Anthem, this hour of the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, after the news.